critical and correct decisions. As Jurashic and Connors ran the launch sim diagnostics, the colonel helped Ackerman and Highlander examine every bolt and weld on the gantry frame. They had just about completed the painstaking work when a shadow female appeared at the far end of the street. Naked except for ragged boots, she walked closer, paused, then fell into a wild, hip-churning dance. Captain Connors' voice filled Gabhardt's helmet.
Well, at least some of the natives are friendly.
She does look glad to see us.
I hope she's got a brother.
Yeah. Sometimes moves like that run in families.
Or not, as in the case of yours.
The grid map reappeared before Gabhardt's eyes. One of the squares blinked in red. Out of their direct line of sight, a pod of laser mines had been tripped.
Key 42.
Gabhardt's battlesuit responded by playing a recording of events that had taken place just seconds before. A lime-green light show, complete with sound. In slow motion, the mine's laser beams passed through the Shadow World humanoids as if they were made of smoke. Of course, smoke never sizzled like that. Appearances to the contrary, the laser mine was one of the most merciful killers in the team's arsenal. In about a second, it produced surprise, pain, oblivion. The anti-personnel system subunits launched in unison, flying in precise formation for 1.3 seconds. With perfectly synchronized rotations, their firing lasers and reflectors created a narrow zone of absolute destruction. When the subunits fell back to the ground, the impact automatically rearmed them for the next jump. Once dispersed in the field, the computer-linked mines never needed service or refueling. They operated via their own threat-level analysis program, based on input from automated sight, chemical, and sound surveillance. In other words, they were perpetual death machines. Gabhardt declined the replay option, and the inside of his visor cleared. Down the street, the naked female still gyrated gleefully. The crack of a rifle shot from behind made the colonel stiffen. Before he could turn to face the source, the bullet had sailed harmlessly past him. Using an infrared scan, he quickly located the shooter crouching in the rubble 90 meters past the end of the street. When Gabhardt cranked the visor's magnification up to 8 power, he saw the middle-aged shadow male taking aim again. He noted the weapon's crude telescopic sight. Then the muzzle winked at him. Thanks to the sensory enhancements of the battlesuit, Gabhardt could actually see the bullet in flight. In his visual array, it appeared as a bright red dot circled in brilliant yellow. Beside the display, 3 sets of numbers scrolled. Projectile caliber, 7.62 millimeters. Projectile speed, 860 meters per second and falling. Distance to impact, 30 meters and falling. 20 meters from impact, the battlesuit automatically triggered a narrow-band deflection pulse of roughly a terawatt. The colonel felt nothing whatsoever. Like magic, the rifle slug simply seemed to curve around him, and as it did, its whine abruptly dropped in pitch. As the entire team watched, the shooter fired his weapon again, with the same result. Gabhardt wondered how long it would take for him to wise up to the fact that he could fire 10,000 bullets, burn out that rifle barrel, and still never come close to the target. Though the artificially intelligent body armor was by no means a perfect defense in every situation, it could handle dozens upon dozens of incoming projectiles at once, projectiles of up to 40 millimeters. Evidence notwithstanding, the shooter stubbornly persisted, preparing to fire once more. Highlander consulted Gabhardt.
He's outside of our AP perimeter, Colonel. Should we just ignore him?
No. I'd better go collect him before he damages something important.
The colonel trotted over to the windowless black gyroplane. At the touch of his gauntleted hand on its side, a panel slid back, revealing the cramped 2-seat cockpit. Gabhardt climbed into the front seat, which immediately inflated and deflated in places, conforming to fit the shape of his body. When that process was complete, the door panel swished shut, and red interior lights came on, allowing him to locate the coupler for the gyroplane's onboard computer. Once he connected his suit's umbilical, the red lights and the blacked-out windows vanished. Both pilot and pilot's seat floated in space. Gabhardt had an unobstructed view in all directions. An illusion, of course. The world outside the aircraft's black skin was being optically scanned by numerous sensors, and after the irrelevant details were filtered out, the end product was projected onto the inside of his visor. The colonel felt a slight vibration as the engine started up. He couldn't see the rear propeller building up speed, pushing the main rotor overhead, because the control program determined those details were unnecessary. However, the climbing RPM and thrust levels were displayed inside his visor. When the rotor reached liftoff thrust, Gebhardt released the skid clamps, and the gyroplane rocketed into the air. It was like flying an armchair, but an armchair that with a stomach-dropping lurch climbed straight up to 300 feet. On command, the chair tipped forward, giving the colonel a panoramic view of the terrain below. He located the running man without difficulty. As he banked to intercept his target, G-force pressed him deep into the contour seat. It was a max-speed dive. At the outer edges of his vision, the surrounding landmarks, the ridgetops, the rock walls, the three-story structures, blurred, then stretched like taffy. Glittering taffy. Gebhardt could have just sat back and watched, letting the computer do all the work, but he enjoyed hands-on flying, especially in combat. Below him, a magnified, lone figure ran inside a superimposed red circle, the gyro's kill zone. He tensed his left index finger inside the battlesuit glove, and the circle shrank until he had the man's right arm isolated. It was the arm that carried the projectile weapon. When the colonel relaxed the muscles of his hand, the fire control system had its target locked in. The circle bobbed up and down, as the man pumped his arms, trying desperately to escape onrushing death from above. After his third shot missed, Gore automatically chambered another live round. Eye pressed to the scope's rear aperture, crosswires on his target's black armored chest, he tightened the trigger to the breakpoint, then paused. He was rapidly losing confidence in the long blaster and starting to get spooked by these muties who made no move to duck for cover. Where were Spadecrawler and Jones? Why hadn't they backed his play? Through the scope, he followed his chosen target as it walked over to the flatbed trailer and climbed up and into the weird black machine that sat on it. He stared fascinated as the bladed thing in back of the fuselage began to spin. Then the bigger bladed thing on its roof began to spin too. Gore had no idea what the machine was supposed to do, but he didn't like the look of it one bit. He was about to put a bullet through its middle, just to see what would happen, when it jumped off its trailer and shot high into the sky. At the sight, Gore panicked. Vaulting over low rubble heaps, he dashed for the base of the ridge, where the boulder fall could provide him some cover. He had crossed no more than one-third of the distance when he sensed the black thing swooping down on him from behind. He felt the terrible pounding of its blades against the air, felt the impacts inside his body, and reacted by cutting hard to the left. The flying machine swept over him, whipping up a cloud of dust. And as it passed by, a pencil line of green light from above cracked a smoking slit in the earth to his right. For a second, it didn't even hurt. Gore felt a sudden sensation of extreme pressure, of constriction just below his right elbow, and something clattered at his feet. He saw the Steyr on the ground, his severed hand and forearm still gripping the forestock. Staring in disbelief at his brand new stump, he smelled burning meat. Then his elbow exploded in pain. Gore fell to the dirt, squealing.
Kind of a piss-poor shot, isn't he?
JB's remark came upon the canny missing for a second time with a stolen long blaster. Ryan squinted through one lens of his binocs.
It sure isn't the rifle's fault. At that range, you should be able to drive nails with it.
Our friends in black down there don't seem to be much bothered by what he's doing. Either that or they're scared stiff.
Don't look scared to me.
Nah, to me neither.
More like they couldn't give a rusty rad blast.
Hey, did you see that?
Where?
Mildred pointed to the left of Main Street.
A brilliant green flash over between the big houses. Just there for a second, bright as day, then it was gone.
Like stun grin flash, no boom. I see.
The Steyr firing a third time brought everyone's attention back to the heart of Moon Boy. The gunshot echoed off the walls of the ridge. The five in black armor remained standing, like statues in the middle of the street. Another miss.
See where the slug skipped? That guy can't hit the broadside of a barn. Kind of humorous, or maybe pathetic.
Pathetic is more like it. He's probably got the Uzi shake so bad he can't keep the sights on target.
If our cannibal colleague is not cautious, he will anger those black-clad folk.
Already has, Doc. One of them's moving.
Ryan watched the figure in black climb up on the trailer and disappear into the windowless aircraft. After a few seconds, its rotors began to turn. First the rear one,